Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both online and on the radio, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure today to introduce Kara Cohen, a native Marin County born person and a recent grad of UCAL in the philosophy department. She also took a lot of art history. And I thought it would be very fascinating when I was approached with this idea to hear to find out, first of all, that there are people still studying philosophy in the 21st century, and to hear what the context is, and, of course, with art as the context, we can't go wrong. Kara.
I feel a little short back here, so hopefully everyone can see me. So I recently received a piece of paper in the mail that represents symbolically or proves that I've completed a Bachelor's of Arts in Philosophy, which doesn't exactly qualify me to do anything. And I'd like to begin by talking a little bit about what an undergraduate degree in philosophy means in contemporary society, and not what getting a PhD means, but what studying philosophy at the undergraduate level is, and not necessarily going on to be a philosopher, which actually still exists. Philosophers do exist, contrary to popular belief. Following, I'd like to open up one of my favorite questions, which is most simply put as, what is art? The ontology of art. How do we define what art is? Which, you know, if you go up to anyone on the street and mention art to them and they say that they don't know what art is, you'd probably be shocked. But once you start opening up the question of what exactly is art, you might find that you're completely confused. So typically when you meet someone new that you haven't spoken or someone you haven't spoken to for a while, and they'll ask you something like, what are you doing nowadays? Or what have you been up to? And, you know, if you're a student, the answer is going to be, oh, I'm a student. Or I'm studying. I'm in school. And then they're going to ask you where you go to school. And then they're going to ask you what you're studying. And so for me, up until a few months ago, the conversation went something like this. Oh, what do you do? I'm in school. That's great. Where do you go to school? Oh, Berkeley. Oh, cool. What do you study? Philosophy. Oh, what are you going to do with that? Actually, this is one of the more generous replies that I've received. The least generous was, good luck working in the service industry for the rest of your life. Someone actually said that to me. I quickly realized that once my identity as a philosophy student was set, that a lot of people, in fact, most people, don't know what philosophy students do and why it could ever be useful. In fact, most people's eyes, philosophers are either ancient, dead, and Greek, or crazy literary and French. In fact, I was once walking behind two engineering students through campus, and they were just racking their brains, trying their darndest to figure out what a philosophy major studies. And the closest answer that they came up with was ethics. And so my answer to the question, what are you going to do with that, is think. I'm learning how to think. And although I feel like there are some incredibly valuable skills that one can learn from practicing philosophy, I've always said that there's only one reason to do it, and that's because you love it. Because one, it is really hard, and it's essentially a form of masochism, because you try to figure something out, try to disprove something, try to prove something, you finally get it, and you get really excited for one brief moment, and then you realize that you're completely wrong, and then you start over again, over and over and over. Two, it's not well respected by the general public. I mean, I guess throughout most of history, it never really was. I mean, Socrates was murdered. And three, it is not necessarily the best field for career options. But, I mean, I think that philosophy students really gain valuable skills, and we learn how to explore every argument, premise, or fact, even the most seemingly obvious ones, from every possible angle that we can. We learn to look for flaws in all that is said. Yeah, I'm really behind on my PowerPoint. Sorry. There we go. There's the thinker. And we learn to look for questions in everything we are told or believe. We learn to map out ideas in terms of logical structures, and then even question those logical structures. No piece of understanding is taken for granted, and no point, no matter how small, is insignificant. We learn that everything we absorb deserves endless contemplation, but also learn that to accept that endless contemplation is impossible. We stop assuming that we are right, and we start assuming that we are wrong. And I think that is part of the beauty of philosophy. Surrendering yourself to the realization that we know so little and basking in the possibilities that emerge from that realization. We get to be highly imaginative, but not without our feet planted firmly on the ground. And in a time where innovation is king and information is valuable above all else, it seems obvious to me why philosophy is not merely an exercise in self-indulgence, but a development of invaluable skills, or invaluable tools, rather, and skills, applicable across all disciplines. So I really believe that philosophy is not something you learn, it's something you learn how to do. And the questions we explore in school are fascinating and important, and I think the questions that I'm going to explore in this talk are fascinating and important. But they're not the only types of questions we can use these tools for. And I think that they can be used for pretty much anything you do in your daily life. And that can be kind of dangerous when you're trying to order a sandwich. But so I'd like to transition to a question that's always been of interest to me, which I've loved having the chance to explore lately. And I'd also like to say that if you have any questions or comments or ideas or insights, feel free to raise your hand at any point, because I would love nothing more than to open up a dialogue. I would rather not talk at you the entire time. I mean, that might be difficult with the whole microphone situation, but we could try to work it out. And, the first thing that I want to mention, which is on my slide here, which may seem odd, is that the main goal that I'd like to accomplish is over the rest of the hour is to have you all leave this room more confused than you came in. So I'm not necessarily trying to answer a question, and I am going to bring up some of my own ideas, but my hope is that I give you so many questions and so many answers and so many problems with those answers that hopefully you'll be completely confused, and I think that's a really good thing. I think that's kind of the eternal state of the philosopher. And I realize this is completely opposite of the intention of most lectures, but I think it'll be fun. And as is typical with philosophy, once I began to dig deeper and deeper into the question I was asking, I realized that my initial scope was wrong, that the philosophers that I wanted to look at originally weren't the ones that I thought would be best to support the ideas that I eventually came up with. So hopefully that won't be a problem, but that's something you basically, as I said earlier, become accustomed to as a student of philosophy, realizing that, writing an entire paper and realizing that you need to start over again and look at completely different points. So instead of taking a more broad classical approach to the study of art and beauty, I'll be focusing more on contemporary philosophers or philosophers over the last 100 years and the ontology or existence of and category of being that is art. So the study of aesthetics spans about as far as philosophy does. And many of the most renowned philosophers have explored art and beauty, beginning with the ancient Greeks. Plato is considered the founder of aesthetics and explores in various dialogues ideas such as the generic idea of art and his principle of measure, the imitative qualities of art and mimesis, the concept of inspiration and erotic madness and beauty. And Aristotle in Metaphysics explored what is art. He also wrote about nature and art, as well as the standard of artistic goodness. Kant's Critique of Judgment is a seminal work in aesthetics, and it covers a lot of different aspects of art and beauty. And Hegel, Nietzsche, Heidegger all held and wrote beliefs about art. Unfortunately, I will not have a chance to dig into these works, but I felt that it was important to mention that they exist and that these questions have always been circulating in philosophy, and encourage all of you to take it upon yourselves to dig deeper than I'll be able to present you with. Aesthetics is, though, only one small part of the a much grander field of philosophy, encompasses many questions that cover both art and beauty, which aren't always related to each other. I thought it was always interesting that aesthetics was art and beauty, when beauty and art can be completely different things. And, you know, there are a few questions that philosophers ask about art. So, what is the value of art? What makes good art? Is there such thing as objectively good and bad art? What is the aesthetic experience? How does our experience of beauty relate to our experience of art? And what I want to discuss in more detail, what is art? The question, what is art, did not become very important in philosophy world until sometime in the 18th century, when the ideal of fine arts was solidified, although some of, you know, philosophers that I mentioned earlier who were clearly before the 18th century did discuss what is art. It didn't become a major topic of conversation in the philosophy world until this time. And at the time, the most common understanding of art was representation. This, of course, makes sense because fine arts at the time and up until that time were almost always representational. Of course, this did not mean mimicking only what was real, like a photograph did, but it did mean representing what was thought to be real, or forms that were real, in contrast to abstractions that we see more at towards the end of the 19th century into the 20th century. Of course, this became a problem. And so this is Marcel Duchamp and the Fountain, which is one of the works of arts that people most use as an example of things, as a piece that most people don't really agree is art. And in case you're not familiar with The Fountain, it's a Dada piece that is just a urinal that's signed by Duchamp. And actually, I skipped ahead by accident. But anyways, one of the things that I wanted to bring up before I started to get into some of the theories about what is art, just to kind of bring up a thought of an experiment to get everyone's brains kind of going a little bit, is just thinking about, and I just want to ask a question to the audience maybe, which is, what is the difference between someone carrying a piece of a can of paint down the street and spilling it on the ground and it looking exactly like the Mona Lisa somehow? We have to expand our imagination to, it's a thought experiment, versus, you know, the actual Mona Lisa. And I mean, I don't know if anyone has an answer to that, but it's just kind of one of those questions that I always thought was really, oh, there you go.
I don't have an answer, but just the question, instead of the Mona Lisa, what about a work by Jackson Pollock? What's the difference
right,
between
or
that?
Jackson Pollock, right. I mean, you could use it with any piece of art.
That would be easier.
It would be easier. I think that... I don't know why this thought experiment isn't typically told with Jackson Pollock. I think it might have to do with the fact that it seems too intuitive and it's easy to just kind of defend Jackson Pollock's purpose in his art and the abstract expressionist theories instead of looking at art as a whole and what makes something art. But I think that's a good point. And I think these are some of the questions that start to get people to think about what is art? Is it intention? Most people, when asked these questions, will say that it's intention. Yes?
Well, every time that something mundane turns out to look like something else, it's attributed to being a miracle. You know, like if you get a grilled cheese sandwich that looks like
Jesus.
Or there's a statue and a tear starts coming down. So when it's intentional, then it's the hand of man. But when it's unintentional, is it the hand of God?
Right. I think that's a good point. I would say that what if someone spilled paint and looked exactly like the Mona Lisa, but the Mona Lisa had never existed? Then it probably wouldn't be considered art. Yeah? Yeah.
I think if it's intentional or unintentional is pretty much irrelevant. I mean, it's, again, in the eyes of the beholder. And I think a good many artists probably didn't achieve what they set out to do, but achieved something that they thought, oh, my God. And when I was in art school, I was one of them. Some of my so-called best works were things that just kind of happened.
I agree, but I'm going to get to that later. I completely agree. So I did a little jump, but I'm going to come back to the 18th century, the mid-18th century, and the idea of art as representational of form. That became a problem pretty quickly, especially when people started to consider music, which was considered art, but is not visually representational of form. And when photography became more popular, I mean, photography is considered art right now. I mean, look around the room. But at the time that it was invented, it was not considered art. And it was highly representational. It was the epitome of representational, but it wasn't art. And... You know, so here's an example of, you know, a representational mid-18th century painting by Giovanni Paolo Panini, The Views of Modern Rome, which is, you know, very focused on representation. And so, you know, and here is one of an early photograph by Louis Daguerre, the maker of the daguerreotype, called Boulevard du Temple, which, I mean, to us looks like a piece of art, right? But I don't think was, as far as I know, was not considered art at the time. It was considered science. And, of course, not only taking into consideration art and music, but art began to change as we entered into, you know, the late 19th century. These theories particularly, they picked up speed, as fine art began to veer away drastically from representation, you know, starting with, you know, impressionism, post-impressionism, symbolism, and, you know, and so on up to color field painting. And you can, I tried to make this image so that you can kind of see the progression away from, you know, formal representation. And so, of course, theorists had to come up with different ideas about what art is because it was no longer defined as representational. Of course, there was still representational art, but not all art was representational. And so Leo Tolstoy wrote a piece in 1898 called What is Art? And R.J. Collingwood's The Principle of Art in 1938 were two highly regarded works at the time that kind of demonstrated the transition in art and the theory of art, which was moving away from the representation of form and towards the representation of expression. And I think that a lot of people right now, when asked what is art, might say something along the lines of what Tolstoy and Collingwood believed, which is that it is an expression of the human condition or the human experience or the artist's experience. And, these ideas focused on expression and experiences, and they had the advantage of encompassing both representational and non-representational art, in terms of the visual form. And Collingwood, referred to the canvas as used to articulate a feeling. And this is a Toulouse-Lautrec painting, which I thought articulated a feeling. And, but even eventually these theories became, inadequate to many, which one of the major counterpoints to this idea is that how do we distinguish art expression, a piece of art, which is an expression of the human condition or experience or just a condition or experience, versus just plain non-art expression. So in terms of these theories, how do we distinguish someone walking down the street just yelling in utter anger or disappointment, or just smiling because they're so happy, they're expressing something, maybe they're visualizing their expression through their facial expressions, or through writing a letter or rather that it's not considered art. And how do we distinguish a piece of art from that? Which I think is a valid point. And so by the mid-20th century, philosophers began to think that maybe it wasn't possible to define art, and that any attempt to do so would be met with counterexamples. The anti-essentialists took the stance that art simply could not be defined. And I'm going to actually come back to the anti-essentialists a little later. But other theorists argued that the failure of past attempts to define art were because they considered features and properties of pieces of art. So these definitions were based on a feature that an art had because it was an expression of a certain feeling. It was a visualization of a feeling or a representation of an object that existed in real life. But in actuality, this is not the way that we can define art, because every piece of art is different, and there were so many different types of art that were emerging very quickly, especially in the mid-20th century. And George Dickey proposed a groundbreaking suggestion that an art object, or at this point, even a performance piece, that a moment of time that's considered art, is actually a social fact. And it depends on no intrinsic property of an object or an experience, but it depends on the context in which it exists. It depends on the relation that it has to other pieces of art. And it is art because it exists in this art world context. This is the art world context. This is a picture of the Guggenheim in New York. When we think of the art world, we often initially think of the big museums and then down to the galleries and the critics. And so the art world context theories, and there were a few slightly, they differed, but they were basically, they basically had similar ideas. James Carney he posited that art is historically connected to general style. What makes art is that it's historically connected to general style features in art. So, I mean, if you look at, this is a pretty simple example, but post-impressionism versus impressionism, or, you know, even just stylistic reactions that look completely different but have some sort of connection. Look at pop art versus abstract expressionism and how it was a reaction to it. And that's what makes something art. It's because it's part of this connected web in the art world. And, you know, Noel Carroll, another more contemporary, or mid-20th century philosopher, I believe, said that, you know, art is something that is situated in a narrative. It's part, an art object or an art experience is part of a grander narrative of the art world. Is that a question?
The question is, why is there a burning need to define what art is? Going back to, you know, a couple thousand years ago and a couple hundred years ago and today, as you pointed out and people in the audience pointed out, definition changes. What's art today wasn't considered art earlier, but the photography changed from science to art. Why are we obsessed with defining what is and isn't art?
I would say that we're not obsessed with that nearly enough, because there are these philosophers who have explored these ideas, but that almost everyone in the world has not, you know, majority of people have never actually thought about it, I would say. And I think that might be a bold statement. Maybe I should take that back. But I would say that people aren't that obsessed with it, and there are some people who have really thought about it, and those writings have had a lot of resonance because they really bring up a lot of ideas, and they make people realize that they don't have a lot of idea about what art is. And actually, one of the speakers at my graduation brought up a really interesting idea about philosophy. And I think that what the question that you brought up is really a question about philosophy in general and not just about defining art, which is why do we ask these questions about things that we're never going to find answers to, or that even if we find answers to, they're not really going to help us very much. And she had an interesting analogy, which was, you know, imagine you're playing a game. You're put into a room and you're told to make this move here and this move then and this reaction to this and that reaction to that. And you're, you know, you're controlling something, you're making something happen, you're existing in this world somehow, but you have no idea why you're doing what you're doing and what you're doing means and what this move, how this move relates to that move and what the meaning of this move is. And I think that you would think that was completely ridiculous, but that's how a lot of us live our lives. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about, you know, we spend a lot of time maybe going to museums, going to art shows, and we don't really spend a lot of time thinking about what it is we're looking at and why. And so I think it's important. I don't think it's important to function in society. I think that you can do perfectly well without asking those questions. But as I said earlier in the beginning of my talk, I think that those questions are kind of freeing because they allow you to be really creative and kind of build the world around you and kind of come up with these ideas of how the world exists around you, and which I think is amazing. We realize that we could have, when we realize that we know absolutely nothing, suddenly we can know pretty much anything. I mean, we can build anything.
So you don't think that you can actually do all the things without defining what art is?
Oh no, I think we can do everything. I just don't think that, I think that it is an interesting topic, and I think that it's interesting to think about, and I think that it's kind of freeing to explore it. And I was talking about, it's about learning these tools, you know? If I'm able to walk in here and define what art is and somehow become one of the best philosophers in the entire world, which I'm not going to happen, and tell you my theory about art, that would be great. And it's probably not going to be what art is, but And
my point
saying,
is, it's exactly what it is. I think you will be as good as the best philosopher because
no one's going to be able to get it. Yeah.
The best philosopher in the world is no more equipped, or you know,
right? Maybe, yeah. But it's about kind of training your brain to think about these things, and you can use those tools to ask questions that, or work on questions that actually do have answers as well. And your brain is better trained to handle those types of questions. But that's a good question. I'm going to move on a little bit. And so we were talking about the art world context, and that an art doesn't have, an object doesn't have an intrinsic, you know, quality to it that makes it a piece of art, but that it is a piece of art because it is connected to other pieces of art in the past or the present. It's a matter of the works existing basically in a network of relationships. And, you know, I think that this initially seems like an excellent way to position art. You know, maybe it doesn't have one of the two major problems with the definitions that I've presented before seem to have. And these are the two major problems that, or at least categories of problems that I've seen as being issues with definitions of art, which are either one, the definition does not encompass everything that we call art, which is some of the representational problems. The first one is if it's representing form, it just leaves out art that does not represent form. And two, the definition encompasses things that we do not call art, which is if we have a definition of art as being an expression or a representation of expression, then that could include things that we don't consider art. And as I talk about some more, you know, philosophies and theories going on, working our way closer to the contemporary, generally everything that at least I'm going to find issue with is going to have one of these things wrong with them. Either they don't encompass everything or they encompass too much. And so what is the problem with the art world context theories? Well, they don't encompass anything that's not Western art, which is kind of an issue. Of course, we could say that other, you know, societies' arts have their own art context, but then that would be a problem too, because there are different types of art contexts. How do you decipher those types of art contexts? And one of the questions I think it was Davies that brought up is that we could even say, is art a Western concept that we apply to the non-Western? Are other certain other cultures, is their art not art the way that we even understand art? Is it not even comparable? Or is art something that exists in human nature? Is it something that has existed in all cultures and is something that in a society, no matter how isolated, would come up with by themselves in a similar way, just like religion has in a lot of ways. And so, I mean, I see that as a major problem. And another problem I see with the art world context is that how did the first work of art come to be? How could you have the first work of art? Because if art only exists because of art world context, then there was no first work of art because there was no art world context. And I think that that's really important, and it gets to the point that we're not actually coming up with any sort of ontology of art. We're just coming up with a way to group art together. But, you know, so it does run into the first problem. It doesn't run into the second problem because, of course, there's no way that the art world context can include anything that's not art because it defines itself as being art initially. But it does leave out certain types of art. And let's see. I'm going to move on a little bit. And so, you know, as we move on into the second half of the 20th century. I'm starting to run out of time. Philosophers started to come up with different ideas of how they could define art, maybe using multiple types of definitions. Art, and maybe you can't define art by one singular purpose or one particular type of property, and that maybe it needs to have some sort of context as well as this type of purpose. And this was something that started happening in the 60s. And we have the anti-essentialists who said that you can't define art. And, maybe there's no way to... maybe there's no way to come up with an adequate definition. Maybe a lot of people believe that we have all of these things that we live with, that we know about, that we can't define. And that's okay. Like, before we didn't know what water was, and we knew what was water. We didn't know that water was H2O. We didn't know that water had certain properties, but we knew we could identify water anytime we saw it. But to me, that means that we just didn't have a definition for water. But and some people say that, how we define art is, right, as it's connected to other things, and that we just know art because it's connected to certain things. But, of course, anything can be connected to anything else, and you can keep going in an infinite regress, and we can include everything. Of course, you can't start connecting things and say that things relate to each other in terms of their connectedness without including everything in the entire world. And so, let's see. So, we have the functionalists who believe that art is designed to serve a purpose. And there were different functionalists who had different ideas. And, they believe that something is only art if it succeeds in achieving an objective that we have for art. So we're not there yet. And so that what makes art is because it achieves an art objective. And, many functionalists believe that maybe that objective is a pleasurable aesthetic experience, which is, I believe, is kind of a vague response. But and a functionalist kind of believes that the value of art is central to its nature, and that it is art because of its value, because of its function of a particular purpose. And then by contrast are the proceduralists, who hold that something is an artwork only if it is made according to the appropriate process or formula. So then you have the art is art because of the process, or how it's made, or why it's made, and maybe that has to do with the medium, or how something is a piece of art because I make it and I put it in a gallery or a museum, and I make it out of a certain materials. And and that actually brings up one of the interesting questions about now, which is new media and art. Why do we now consider photography art, and we consider film art. We don't necessarily consider video games art, or websites art, or interactive web games art, or all these new different types of technology that are coming out as art. And it's interesting to think about, are we eventually? And, when we look back at when film and photography first came out, they weren't art either. And so art is always evolving. It's completely changing. And a lot of philosophers acknowledge the fact that art is always changing, and that's one of the reasons why we can't have a definition for it. Maybe you can't have a definition for art for something that's completely changing all the time. But we have a definition for food, and food changes all the time. We eat completely different foods than we have in the past, and we're probably going to make up new foods. And, corn syrup, right? And I don't think that corn syrup existed hundreds of years ago. And so I don't think that's a really great answer. Yeah, and that's kind of the do we expect too much from a definition idea. And so I don't think we do. I think that that's kind of a cop-out. I think that maybe we can't come up with a definition, and we're not able to come up with a great definition, but I don't believe that there is no definition out there. And actually, you know, I don't know. I go back and forth. So now I'm going to take a couple minutes. I think I only have about 15 minutes left. So the title of my talk was Art as Context, right? So I did talk a little bit about context in terms of the art world context, which I mentioned that I disagree with for a couple of reasons, which are that you can't account for the first instance of art, and you can't account for different types of art world context. And I think that I agree that art is context, and that we do view art not because of any intrinsic properties. I do believe that it's impossible to have any sort of intrinsic qualities that we agree upon cover all of art, because art is changing so much. So what if we decided to look at art not as something that an object can be, that an object is art, that object exists as art, but as art is just a way of looking at an object? I think that you can look at any object in an art context. And I think this woman was saying earlier, you might not know what you're getting. You might not know what you might not have an intention. Or you like Duchamp's The Fountain, you might take a urinal and make it into an art object and not actually do anything to it. And I think that this way of saying that art is not an object. Art is a way of viewing an object. It's a way of experience an object. And you can't actually define any object as being art. Really escapes some of the major problems that definitions that we've had with definitions of art, which it allows anything to be art, and it doesn't encompass things that aren't art, because it says that anything could be looked at as art. And I think that part of the reason why display is so important to the way that we view art, why it is important that we have art in galleries, that we have art in museums, and that we have art on walls or with a certain amount of space about it, is because there's this suggestion to the audience of you should be looking at this in an art context. You should be looking at this object in an art way, not this is an art object. I mean, you can put anything on a pedestal or hang anything on a wall, and people walk into a room and they will look at it in an art way, whether or not it was intended to be a piece of art. And I think that's part of the reason why some people see nature as art and some people don't see nature as art. And some people don't agree on what art is. Some people think that art requires a craft, and some people think that art requires a certain amount of a thought behind it, an intention. And I think that really just has to do with how you are able to look at things as art, whether or not you are able to see art in an object. Of course, this could not be a fully formed philosophical theory, because it doesn't explain what makes that experience, what makes that art experience, and how we, what makes viewing something as art different from viewing something in a normal sense. I mean, there's definitely a difference, and I think that almost anyone has experienced that difference of looking at something in an art way versus looking at something in a functional way, or just in terms of it just being in existence or being in the way or being out of the way, or how, whether it's, you know, some use some Heidegger terms, ready to hand or unready to hand, you know, so I think that I'm not necessarily trying to say that my way of looking at art is the right way and the best way, but I was just hoping to open up maybe a different way of looking at it and kind of begin sort of that process. And Yeah, that's it. So if anyone has any questions about anything that I said or comments or ideas, then feel free.
Well, thanks, Kara. Thanks, Kara, for the talk. And we'd like to remind our audience online and on the radio that you are hearing Kara Cohen talk about artist context at the Commonwealth Club of California. It's time for questions and answers. And the first one is right.
With all due respect, you haven't changed my mind about art. And I'd like to give you my definition.
Great.
My definition of art is a beautiful 23-year-old granddaughter beautifully expressing her thoughts. And to me, that's art. And I thank you so much.
Thanks, Grandpa.
That's a perfect definition. Just in case the online and radio audience didn't recognize that, that was Kara's grandfather. Does anybody else want to take an attempt at a definition for art before we go on to other questions? A definition for art?
I would like to start about art with I have a 5 years boy that is using my computer and makes a lot of very good paintings there, like that. And I asked him, what are you doing? And he said, I'm trying to show what I have in my imagination. And this is my imagination. You see my imagination. And I think he gave the basic answer. What is art? That art is imagination. And later, we accepted that anything could be art. But we are missing the main links about that. How this imagination, how well it is done, how much this imagination is built and to convince us in the truthfulness of what we see. When I saw by Rembrandt, the Night Guard. When I was there in the museum and I saw that picture, definitely I was capable to say, I haven't seen any other painter capable to create such a thing. And that was definitely the essence of art, that you can say you are seeing somebody is so talented that you can never do the same thing. You don't. It's a very rare expression and very rare, I would say, source of expression.
That's an excellent classical approach toward the subject, and I'm going to get back to something else in a second here, but another definition, Steve's got one.
I wonder where the word art comes from and whether it's related to other words that give us hints, such as artifice. And when you were talking about context, the word artifice came to mind. I don't know if art comes from artifice, but I think what you were talking about was taking an object or creating an object that's somehow different from what we experience directly in our everyday mundane lives and putting it into a different way of looking at it through some form of artifice. And I'd be interested in the etymology and whether you looked into that.
Yeah, I was actually going to do that, but I ended up getting distracted.
Would you like to do it now?
Oh, look, no, man, I was going to look up the etymology of art, and I didn't get around to it, unfortunately. I shouldn't admit that.
Before we pass too far away from the Mockingbirds here, I wanted to ask the question. When you tried to define food or said it was clear to us what food was and used corn syrup as part of food, I thought Susan's sitting here going, the corn syrup is not food. She spoke last month on exactly the philosophy of food, and I'm sure corn syrup was not part of the definition. Another attempt to define art. Okay.
I think that art might be
recognition of form from the eye of the beholder's experience. But I think the question that you're asking is very much the same as, is there any sound when a tree falls in the forest?
Right, so does art exist independently from our subjective experience from it? Which I would say absolutely no. That's my opinion. But I could see how other people might have different opinions because they might consider art as something that, you know, right, an expression of an imagination. Of course, you can, if someone is able to express their imagination and put it on a piece of canvas, then regardless of whether or not everyone else in the world disappears, that's still an expression of imagination, which, and I think that, that's not my personal belief in what art is, but I think that it's a very interesting way to think about it as well.
Well, those of you who heard me talk about the emotions and trying to define the emotions, come up with a definition of something that's abstract that every person experiences differently. It's a fairly similar experience here with art because it is, you know, what is the similarity in the pattern of the experience for everybody, even though everyone will make different choices. What is the similarity in the pattern, if you want to try to define it? That's where I think we have to start. And I have a definition, but first I have to define another term, and that's the term beauty, because this is a little bit different too, and it's very grandfatherly on the one part, and it explains something, I think, very clearly, because beauty, people think about it in terms of maybe symmetry, or, you know, there's a lot of different definitions of what actually constitutes beauty, but we put beauty onto a lot of things, including what a lot of people will call ugly, other people will call beautiful. If it's deformed, but it makes you feel a certain way, you're going to call it beauty. So, I knew an artist many years ago, and she represented her own imagination, which was filled with terror from her earlier experiences, and it looked ugly to everybody else, but to her, it was beautiful because it represented something from inside her, something from her imagination. Now, a lot of other people wouldn't pay for that, but she certainly would have called that art, and other people might not have. And I think, so the definition of beauty, I think, is crucial first. And my definition for beauty is fairly simple. It's the quality that promises, a quality in an object or something that promises happiness to us. I won't go into defining happiness because that's a whole other regression. But then the definition of art would be fairly simple, because you would say it's a detailed attempt to express beauty. It's a detailed attempt to express something that you call the promise of happiness. I see a lot of disagreements. But that's because what's happiness? Happiness is when you fulfill a desire. It's the emotion caused by the fulfillment of a desire. And therefore, it can have a whole range of experiences that qualify as a pattern. And if you take something like photography or film, when it was first started, or as it's used by lots and lots of people, average photography is not a detailed attempt to express beauty by most people. These are a detailed attempt to express beauty of some kind, something that in the photographer creates that feeling that there's some promise of happiness. So I think I'll go to the woman who would like this to stop.
Okay, thank you for your talk. It really helped me clarify my ideas. I think art is an expression. So my friend here makes expressions that I love so much, I put them on my wall. But art in the social context, to me, what is considered art is defined by the movers and shakers, like mm-hmm. Peggy Guggenheim, who made Jackson Pollock. And it opened up a whole, like, yes, art is whatever you choose to make it. It's a human instinct to express ourselves.
I would just like to say also one thing. I think the reason we feel like we need to define art is because by doing so, we can grant it value. What goes into a museum? What goes to a garage sale? What might I want to keep? And you think, no, just throw that away. Hey, this is a good thing, this is a beautiful thing, this isn't worth anything. I kind of feel that that's why we need to define it, because we need to give it value or definition.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, I think that with the question that was asked earlier about why do we have a need to define art, I think that was a much better answer than mine. Of course, I think that there are some people who might have, and I think there are some people who do want to define art for that reason, or a lot of people who do want to define art for that reason, especially art critics. But I think that some people come up with definitions of art that completely exclude value. And I think that a lot of the definitions that I've run across and the ones that I have held for myself and the ones that I discussed really kind of put art in the place of there is no way to have good or bad art, which, of course, is a difficult thing to prove because there are so many pieces of art that affect people so much more than other pieces of art, and I think that that deserves further exploration, which is, I think, part of the reason why I wanted to talk about this subject in particular, is because the more you talk about it, the more questions come up, at least for me. And I think that's a good point.
Coming off of your question, or your idea of value and putting it within that, I was thinking of it in that way and thinking, well, if we weren't living, would we still be asking this question if we weren't living in a world that had so much emphasis on value?
Yeah,
okay, sorry. I was just wondering if we were, would we still be asking the question of what is art if we weren't living in a world where we were putting so much emphasis on value and monetary or not? But
do I have a response? I think so. I think that people would still. I think that people would still wonder about the question. I think that people might wonder differently, and I believe that if we didn't emphasize value of art, there would probably be a lot more art, if that makes any sense. I think that people would make a lot more art if they didn't feel a pressure to have that art have value. And I think that maybe it might actually become a bigger question because there'd be more people making art. But I of course, that's hypothetical. But I think that it both of those comments are interesting and something that I didn't have enough time or space to really touch on, which is the art's relation to value, either monetarily or the aesthetic value that art has, and whether or not it has an intrinsic value or societal value or personal value. And I think that's one of the other huge questions that you could ask about art among many others. Rachel? Or?
Did you read any Roland Barthes in your studies?
Sorry, I just choked myself. No, I did not.
I'm very hazy on this. This is like about 20 years ago for me, but I remember something about the word jouissance, joy. If I remember correctly, he wasn't emphasized. His emphasis was that you really cannot encompass it. You cannot come up with a complete definition of art,
mm-hmm.
or any other kind of a major cultural artifact or a basic concept. But there's just a joy in discussing it and thinking about it. You just come up with this infinite variety of different ideas and brings everybody together. Everybody's mind opens up, and it's just endless. There's just this endless joy that you get. It's sort of like walking through Paris along the Seine all day, you know,
mm-hmm.
and seeing it, you know, in spring and just seeing the sun shining on the flowers, going through a museum or something like that. But if you try to define it too stringently, you diminish it. If you don't try to define it, you also diminish it too. It's just this infinite joy in at least constantly having a dialogue, constantly thinking about it. And Barthes' writings, there's just this love of ideas, this love of looking into different meanings without really trying to get into the bottom of something too harshly.
Yeah, I think that that actually, at least if I'm understanding you correctly, that fits in, for me, it fits in pretty well with what the way that I want to define art. And I don't necessarily want to say that I've defined art, or at least the direction that I want to go with defining art, which is that it is more about the experience of viewing than the intrinsic qualities or the relational aspects of being part of this web, but just kind of the context of being that in that experience, and not necessarily the properties of an object or a moment if we're looking at more performance art or music. And I think that's interesting what you said.
We have time for one more question.
I think you're making an excellent point about art being more experience and art as a viewing, as a process, as emotions of the viewer than an object itself. I think this way, you know, avoids a lot of the, you know, difficulty in defining art as we tried earlier. But I just wanted to ask a question, Valeria, that said earlier about the value of art and what goes to the garage sale and what goes to the museum. Was Toulouse-Lautrec any less of an artist when he couldn't sell a painting? Van Gogh couldn't sell a painting during his lifetime, and now it's sell for $100 million. No, what was that? I'm just...
Value monetarily could that too, but like giving it value, you know what I mean?
No, I understand, but you made a comment about what goes in the museum, what goes in the garage sale. I'm just saying, so Van Gogh didn't sell a lot of paintings during his life. And he's setting all kinds of records at auctions today. So I think it's an experience, not the dollars.
Sometimes it takes an audience 100 years to catch up. but I'm sorry, but we've run out of time. But I want to thank Kara for that great presentation. That concludes another Commonwealth Club event in its 108th year of Enlightened Discussion.